Nobody covers dog sledding like Mushing from First Paw Media. Our team of athletes, volunteers, race organizers, and mushers like Robert and Michelle Forto brings you closer to the sport. If it's happening, we are there. Live from the qualifying races in January and February, the Iditarod in March, and in the summer, Mushing takes you on the road with our team and trail tour. We connect you with a history of the sport, in-depth interviews with the top mushers, and great storytelling and breaking news all year long. Follow on mushing.com.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert, and I'm sitting here with Jonathan Hayes. We're talking about his expedition. This is episode 5 or 6 of this series. We are deep into this. He is getting ready to pull into Nome in our story, and for a lot of people, this is a life-changing moment. Whether you're doing an expedition, or you are running Iditarod, or whatever, this is the time to really think about what did all this mean and why in the world did we do all of this. So here we are in Iditarod time. This is coming under the Burled Arch. This is making it to the last stop on the journey. Can you tell us a story about coming into Nome? So you've been on the trail now almost 3 weeks. You've thought about this every day of your life for the last few years. You and I have known each other 4 or 5 years now, and we've talked about this moment for a long time. Tell us about that, coming into this little hamlet of 2,500 people in the middle of nowhere on the western coast of Alaska.
God blessed us with this beautiful orange painted sunset coming into Nome. And I was alone because all the snow machines broke down and they're back trying to get everything, you know, and I'm just able to, you know, just be present with the dogs. I have a really bad tendency not to let myself enjoy things. I don't allow myself to celebrate until something is done, you know, accomplishment. And with this, as you just pointed out, there's so much in the preparation. And to me, although I was about to pull into Nome, my brain was still working on logistical problems.
You still had to get home.
Yeah, we had cargo flights to book and money to shift around to pay for it, airline flights, and then I had to pay 5,000 miles of a diesel rig with, you know, a 32-foot trailer to travel across the country to get home. Just all of these logistical things bouncing around in my head, and then I yelled at myself and I said, "Jonathan, stop." I said, "You are on Leonard Sepulveda's team of dogs. You're mushing Leonard Sepulveda's team of dogs. You are about to mush into Nome 100 years after the Serum Run saved the children of Nome. You're about to mush into Nome. You need to be present and just soak in this moment." And so I did. I shoved every care, every, you know, tomorrow this, tomorrow that. I still have to do this, still have to do that. I pushed it all aside. And I'm just gonna be present in this moment, and I'm just gonna, you know, soak it in. And I actually said a prayer. I actually prayed, and I said, you know, for my dogs. And I said, "God, I don't know if my dogs are capable of feeling anything like, you know, this connection with their ancestors who mushed in and out of this town 100 years ago. But if they can feel anything akin to what I'm feeling right now, this, you know, to me, a spiritual moment coming into Nome, then let them feel that." And I really feel like they did. I mean, they were on cloud 9. They were just, you know, smooth, flowing gait. You know, the ptarmigan were flying up from the bushes and this orange sunset. And just, man, I allowed myself to be present, soak it in. And it was such a blessing. And then Alaska slapped me in the face again, because right before the first road crossing, I mean, there were cars lined up, there were honking horns, you know, people were standing there, and the wind was howling, but, you know, hey, I'm in Nome. and I'm just about to pull up onto the first road intersection, and I hit a patch of glare ice, and there was open water over there. And my sled just starts flying with me sideways, and all 16 of my dogs are being pulled backwards in front of all these people, you know, just being dragged across the ice by the wind. And I'm like, seriously? I mean, I'm in no, all this is supposed to be behind me now. You know, I can't blow out my leg right now, you know. You know, we just found just enough purchase, you know, to claw our way back onto some snow and get up onto the road again. But man, it was beautiful. And like you said, it was a culmination to so much. And you pull into town and Nome is so welcoming. And, you know, I got to be a precursor to the Iditarod Mushers. So it was the first, you know, dog team coming into town and a full complement of 16 dogs marching down Main Street. It was a beautiful sight. You know, but as beautiful as it is, you know, there's a part of you that you've just gotten into this rhythm with your dogs and you don't want it to be over. You know, you just, and I know Gary Paulson, you know, mentioned this coming into Nome. He had the same feeling of, you know, just wanting to turn around and go back. And I didn't necessarily want to turn around and go back, but I just wanted to keep going, you know. I didn't want it to be over, you know.
I assume this is the same spot, and this is probably the most ironic thing about a trip like this, Jonathan. The Iditarod Trail comes off of the sea ice and onto Main Street at this particular spot in Nome, and I'm sure it's the exact same spot. But did you know that pulling up back into civilization after 700 miles of running, did you know the first thing that you're going to pass is a Subway?
Yeah, I know that spot.
Yeah, is that the same spot?
Isn't that crazy? Yeah, so we did come into town a bit east of that, but I know the exact spot that you're talking about. And yeah, isn't that crazy? And you know, it's just, it's so odd to see that after, you know, living in these, you know, remote villages for so long.
Yeah. So yeah, you can grab a Subway sandwich right off the Iditarod Trail, and a foot long combo will cost you somewhere close to $30. Oh, yeah. So yeah, I've been there many times, but you come into the finish there, Jonathan. I know you met with the mayor and all that sort of stuff. Set the scene for us. You're there. You're done. What's it like?
I was a little confused because I'm in this routine, you know, back to that whole routine. My brain is just in this routine. And so I dropped my snow hooks, which means absolutely nothing because, you know, even in the Iditarod, they have snow carted into town so that they have, you know, some snow to run on. I was on a plowed glare ice concrete road. And of course my snow hooks, they just clink, and I'm tie myself off to a snow machine. And, you know, the mayor's there and I'm walking by the mayor to go check on my dogs, you know, just like I'm in a routine, you know, and, kids are pouring out and crowding around the dogs, and people that I know, the pastor of the Covenant Church there at the finish line, he comes out to greet me. And, you know, all, you know, the curator of the Nome Museum comes out, and, several other people I know, the mayor and some reporters. And like, they don't exist to me, you know, they're not even there. I'm just
your tunnel vision, I'm just trail
looking at
miles.
My dogs, yeah. I'm looking at my dogs, making sure they're okay and everything's good. And I actually kneeled down and I'm petting my dogs. And then I realize that the mayor and these TV reporters are standing back at my sled. And I'm like, yeah, I probably better go back and talk to them.
Yeah. Yeah. So you soaked in the moment, if you will. When did, because you said that your team has had to go back and get, I believe you said Caleb in a previous episode, Caleb's machine broke down. At what point in this timeline did you guys finally have everybody together?
Yeah.
And what did you guys think? You know, here you are, you're at the finish.
We synced up just a couple miles out of town. So they caught back up with me.
Okay.
Just a couple miles out of town and came in with me. And I told them, actually, that this It's primarily about the dogs, but this was a team expedition, and I was not going to mush into town without them.
Okay.
And so when I thought that I would make it to Nome before them, my plan was to find a place to park, wait until, even if it was 1 o'clock in the morning, I was going to cruise into town, you know, with my team, and I was going to wait until they caught up. But thankfully, they caught up with me just a couple miles out of town. We came in together. I hit the paved road, and the dogs decided to go down the paved road instead of crossing to hit the snowmobile trail. And I did not have carbide tips on my brakes still, so I was cursing about that. And you know, finally persuaded the dogs to get off this easy paved road and get back on the trail again, you know, for this little jaunt into town.
Excellent. So here we are. We're at the finish. A bunch of questions here. This is all about reflection. This is a big picture question. This is a philosophical question. After the finish, Jonathan, how did the expedition change you?
It definitely changed me. And I'm sure Iditarod mushers feel this way too, but you know, you keep thinking that you're doing big things with your dogs, and then you do something bigger, and then the things you did before don't seem that big. And that's not to downplay the things that you did before or you know, or other people who are doing that. It's just, it changed me mostly in that I'd raised all of these dogs, but I got to know these dogs in a way I saw things in these dogs I'd never seen before. I learned them in a way that I'd never learned them before, or could not have learned them had I not been out on an expedition like this. The dogs showed me their mettle in a way that training runs just aren't going to do.
Yeah. Interesting. I have a dog question coming up here this early in the segment here, but you've got to the finish. You know, you've done all this lead up to this. What role did community and education play in the preservation of this breed after everything that's to this point?
And that's really important. The purpose of this expedition was to not only, you know, to celebrate the breed, the Zeppelin, but was to commemorate this heroic expedition, this heroic serum relay. And so to us, connecting with the schools, which we took a lot of time to do off trail, to connect with the school children, to connect with the Covenant Churches. The Covenant Churches are the predominant Christian denomination on the coast, that region of the coast. And so connecting with their community churches, connecting with the schools, and telling them, you know, we came into Unalakleet, and I'm trying to remember the Ivanov. One of the teachers said Ivanov was a musher from our village, and I think it was you. I don't remember now, but she said, if you're a descendant of Ivanov, stand up. And like half of the class stood up.
Wow.
You know, and so it was just so cool to connect and help them celebrate. Because, you know, if we hadn't, there would have been there would not have been a serum run celebration. So to celebrate that serum run with them, to say, you know, 17 of the 20 original serum run mushers were natives. So, you know, sharing that with the native kids and saying, this is your story. You know, this isn't really my story. This is your story. This is your heritage. So that was the message that we brought to the schools. To the elementary schools, to the older kids, and at the churches, it was a little heavier of a story that we were telling. And that story was, you know, I come from a very strong military family. You know, I lost an uncle to PTSD. I have two sons that are struggling with PTSD after their military service. It led me to, you know, my oldest son lost 13 of his comrade in arms in Kabul, but then the first year he was home from Kabul, lost more than that to suicide. And as you know, being an Alaskan resident, suicide, you know, in these villages is a pandemic. it really is a pandemic. So the message that I was bringing to the older teens and, you know, and in the community churches was, you know, so many people have sacrificed so much so that you can be here. They didn't give up. These, you know, these serum run mushers, you know, these, I would say to the teenage kids, they knew that every hour they lost was another lost life, another child lost. You know, and if others have sacrificed so much and didn't give up so that you could be here, don't be so quick to give up on yourself. You know, that was the primary message that we were trying to bring.
So that was your quote-unquote serum you were delivering.
Yes.
Your message was the message of hope in terms of PTSD or whatever. Yeah. And I know a lot of the previous Serum Run expeditions, they had that mission. Whether it was, you know, delivering a message of hope on suicide awareness or rabies vaccines or whatever, they all brought some type of message which harkens back to that original Serum Run. So which is the next question? It's about the path, right? I remember telling my wife Michelle that our position as the owners of Mushing Magazine and this podcast, you know, we have people listening all over the world. Our mission in this is to be able to hold on to the stories to share them to others. What was your path for this? What did you want the world at large to hold on to? Was it that message of hope? Not necessarily the villagers, but in a grand scheme of things, what were you trying to get across that shaped this journey?
And there were times in the journey when I was asking myself that question, you know, because my message in the villages, that, you know, that message of hope and, you know, that there is always hope for the future, you know, and my dedication to the breed of the Cephalus Siberian Sled Dog, wanting to see it go into the future. And then on a larger scale, I've been... I don't know if you've heard of this, but they call it the... there are different intelligences, you know, and there's a book called The Last Child in the Woods. I think his name was Richard Louvre, who wrote it, talked about nature intelligence. And, you know, for thousands and thousands of years, humans have lived in this relationship with the created world. You know, our hands are in the soil, we're raising plants, we're touching animals, you know, we're traveling by horse, we're traveling by dog, we're hunting, you know, subsistence, we're raising plants. And then just in the last century, after thousands and thousands of years of that hardwiring, we're completely disconnected from the created world. Like completely, we you know, our climate is controlled by a thermostat. You know, we travel in these machines that we've made. Everything around us is synthetic. And, you know, we've really become unplugged from the natural world. And I believe that mushing is one of these things that ties us to creation, to the creator, to the natural world, that is worth preserving. It seems antiquated. It seems like it does not have, and that's why, again, I love traditional dogs, because it's not about winning a race. It's not about having a trophy. It's about really being able to experience this primal communion with the created world, with my dogs, you know, feeling. You go through this, you know, this little pass, and the temperature drops 5 degrees, and then you come out of this little hollow between the hills, and you know, the temperature, you feel it on your skin, the temperature goes back up, and the dogs feel it, and you know, you've got a raven dancing in front of your team, you know, and thinking, wow, Leonard Cephalus said that it was a raven dancing in front of his team that won him his first dog sled race, and you know, here they are dancing in front of my team as we're coming into Nome. And you know, these little things. I think it's part of our primal heritage that is worth preserving, because it connects us to the natural world in a way that other things can't.
And that's probably my last question, so I'm probably going to repeat that in just a second. But let's jump into some things that you learned along the way. The first one is, what are some of the most valuable skills you believe outdoor leaders should develop in succeeding in their adventures? And did you learn any skills that you thought you knew before you did this that you know now?
Yeah, I thought I knew. I mean, there's one thing to train in the Marine Corps for cold weather. There's another thing to experience it, you know, for several hours a day and then going into a heated building. But I thought intellectually, I thought I knew, you know, I told you this already, I thought I knew my dogs, but I really learned them in a different way. And I also thought I knew what it was like, you know, in minus 50, minus 60 for extended periods of time, how I would deal with that. And I came to be a bit more comfortable with it than I thought that I would be. I'd never experienced that degree of cold before until this expedition. And then finally, what was the other part of your question?
What are some of the most valuable skills that outdoor leaders should develop?
Yeah, it's not the practiced skills. It's a mental fortitude. And, you know, if you read books on the age of golden age of exploration, or even if you just watch the show Alone, you know, where these people who, you know, go out for, oftentimes it's the people with the most skills that tap out the fastest. They've got great skills, but, you know, they're breaking down and crying, and, you know, they just, you know, they miss home, they miss, you know, the comforts of life, they can't handle being alone. And so, you know, I think really the greatest skill that needs to be developed is just this, you love people, you love your team, but there has to be this independent degree of fortitude that says, I'm just going to persevere because it doesn't make sense to do anything else.
Next is a reflection on risk management and safety. How do you approach risk management and safety in the outdoors while encouraging exploration now that you're done? You said earlier that you thought you knew things. You had this mantra of the mission to complete this. All of that is wrapped up into safety and risk. How did this trip change your approach to risk management and safety?
I am pretty willing to take risks as an individual. I'm pretty willing to take big risks as an individual. However, I'm not willing to risk the life of my dogs or my team. So that's where the balance had to come in for me is I think there were close to 5 or 6 dogs 100 years ago that died in a relay of the serum run.
The original
yep. Serum run. I think there were 5 or 6 if memory serves. And that was a relay. And we're going to run the entire thing, and losing a dog is not an option. It is not an option. So you know, there's that, I'm willing to take extreme risks, but I'm not going to take any risks that's going to, you know, jeopardize the life of one of my dogs. And that's where I find the balance is my dog safety. What can we do here that's going to push the envelope without, you know, risking a dog's life?
Do you have any takeaway from what you learned about risk or safety now that it's done, that if you had to teach a course on expedition behavior or leadership or anything, would you say, guys in the class, guys, this is something that you need to write down? Is there anything? Whether they're doing a hiking trip or a dog sled expedition or whatever.
Yeah, redundancy is important. And this was, I was shocked to see in modern adventure and modern exploration, explorers and modern adventure, there's an assumption that technology is going to save you. even with modern adventurers and modern explorers. There's this assumption that it's going to be there. I was talking to a modern explorer recently about how I always bring a compass and a map of every region that I'm traveling through. And I was told that that was unnecessary. And the funny thing is I got just 3 days into this expedition and my Garmin inReach broke off of my bibs and got lost. And for the rest of the expedition, I was looking at my Alaska Atlas and Gazetteer with my compass. And, you know, and there were, so redundancy, having backup plans and being comfortable with them. That map and that compass doesn't do you any good if you're not comfortable with it. So don't put all your eggs in one basket. Make sure that make sure that you've got redundancies in place so that if something in, because it will, when something fails, especially if it's tech, when the tech fails, that you're ready and able to go old school.
This is a leadership question, not necessarily a dog or expedition type, but can you share a story in terms of reflection, a particularly challenging part of this expedition, and what leadership lessons did you learn from that experience?
You might have to edit this because I'm having to rack my brain here to think of something specific. For me, it was bringing a team together of people that didn't know each other and managing that throughout the expedition. You know, when you know someone and they're your friend, you give them the benefit of the doubt. You don't know them, you don't give them that benefit of the doubt. And so trying to foster that immediate sense of community in the team, you know, that... you know, we're brothers, you know, we're in this together. That's easy in the Marine Corps because you have this camaraderie because you've gone through the same stuff to get to where you're at to become a Marine. So you have this sense of camaraderie and you have that in other aspects of your life. But when you're bringing a team together that doesn't really know each other and doesn't have that invested interest in one another, you have to work really hard to foster that in the team.
With your team, Caleb and what's the other guy's name?
Jeff and Jamie.
Jeff and Jamie, and then we have Caleb. I assume that you've spent some time with Jamie and Jeff prior, but Caleb was a relatively late addition. How much time did you spend with these guys, sans the 5-day drive? How much, you know, time did you get to know each other?
I've been bashing on technology. Now I'm gonna give it some kudos. The great thing about the age that we live in is I could set up Zoom meetings weekly and do an hour long, you know, sit down and, you know, chit chat with each other. I created group chats where, you know, whenever there was something pivotal in the preparation for the expedition, I could say it once and it goes to all three guys. So Jeff, I got to spend one day with before the expedition, and the same with Caleb. Both of them, we had our expedition 101 weekend where we all came together, but 4 weeks before that we were, in Zoom meetings together and in chat groups together, trying to build some of that camaraderie. Yeah, for the most part, you know, the team worked exceptionally well together, you know, despite not really knowing each other that well before.
And I assume that the other guys had only known... Jeff knew Jamie, right?
Jeff only knew Jamie, okay. And Caleb didn't know
anybody.
Yeah.
So he was the new kid on the block, so yeah, to speak.
That was one of those gut choices with Caleb. I was given a friend of mine who knows a lot of outdoor adventure filmmakers, gave me a list of four filmmakers that all four of them were interested in joining us. And I chose the one with the least long-term experience, because his art just spoke to me more than the other guys' work. The other guys had more lived experience out in the field, but this was a young man, up and coming. Caleb was young, up and coming. He was hungry, you know, to get out there and to do something epic. And so for me, I just kind of made the gut decision to go with the guy who has his career ahead of him rather than behind him, and had more hunger in his belly for adventure than people who would just, you know, do this for a living day in and day out.
Excellent. And I'm excited to hear what's next from that in just a few minutes. So, environmental stewardship. Anytime that we spend time in the outdoors, they have all sorts of things like leave no trace and things that we are supposed to do when we're out there. How did you foster a sense of environmental stewardship and responsibility within your team and community throughout this whole process?
Yeah, we're dealing with a lot of packaged snacks and a lot of packaged dog food and little, you know, day supplies of chicken fat, day supplies of beaver, and all of that's in packaging, you know. And, you know, I told the guys, you know, if you see anything that fell out of my sled, or if I see anything that fell out of your snow machine, you know, let's take the time to pick it up. You know, obviously there's the, you know, the temptation to, you know, you've got all this gear on, it's 40, 50 below, it's, you know, you're tempted to just drop something. But, you know, I encourage the guys not to do it. And my sled was a testament to it. When I got to Nome the next day, I was asking, you know, where I could dump trash, because my sled was just literally filled with Raptors and containers and all that stuff that I'd been carrying along with me the whole way. Every week you go out in the wilderness, and it's the same here in Maine's Northwoods, you can go out today into a stretch of the wilderness and then go out 2 weeks later, and it's a completely different experience because the wilderness has changed. You know, the stage that the plants are in, the stage that the animals are in, the whole dynamic has shifted. And that is magnified to the extreme in an area like what we mushed through. You know, you're talking about, we had almost 100-degree temperature shift in 48 hours. And I'd argue that, you know, in that sense, I was an explorer. Our team were true explorers, because we were in virgin snow, in virgin regions of that, you know, gets traveled heavily. In fact, the Iditarod ended up using the same route that we used.
Two months later, almost to the day.
That's right. And so,
month later, I guess it would be.
Yeah. So yeah. People travel it, but not when we traveled it.
Yeah.
And not seeing what we saw. And it was so pristine. It was so beautiful. And again, I go back to that portage between Caltag and Unalakleet. Other than some trappers' traps along the way, and that's something that any musher that goes through there will probably no doubt remember, because the trappers on snowmobiles, they don't go off the trail to set their traps. They set them right on the trail. So thankfully, my dogs, even with animals in the traps, didn't stop for them. But other than those, you know, trappers' traps, it was just wilderness. Just mm-hmm. beautiful, beautiful wilderness. And, you know, it's just somewhere you wish, you know, your soul could just stay.
You know, you live here in northern Maine, similar climate to where we're at. I live in Willow, Alaska, which is in this weird climate compared to a lot of Alaska. I've lived in Alaska for a little over 15 years, and I've really seen climate change happening. Winters are different. Snow is different. Much more rain up there. Did you see, obviously you haven't traveled a lot of this trail before, but did you see the impacts at all of climate change and how fast it's happening in Alaska, maybe compared to where you live?
Yeah, I can't, like you said, I can't authoritatively speak to Alaskan climate change because I don't have a
reference point
other than all I can say is, you know, the people who've lived there and mushed there their entire lives, like Aaron Burmeister, were saying these conditions are unprecedented. And a 100-degree temperature shift in 48 hours, you know, those kinds of things are just, it's really hard to prepare for that kind of stuff. I will say here, people often get frustrated when they want to come see Arcephalus. They say, hey, we're traveling through Maine. I've been getting this a lot since the expedition even. We're here from Norway, and we're going to be in Maine, and we'd like to come by Poland Spring and see your dogs. And we're like, yes, we're still in Maine, but we're not in Poland Spring anymore. Oh, why not? Well, 100 years ago, Poland Spring Resort was having an annual dog sled race. 20 miles, 3 days in a row. They have not been, and they want to, but they have not been able to put on that Poland Spring Dog Derby in the 20 years that the owner of the resort and I have been talking, because they've not had the snow conditions, you know, in a decade to run a race that they were running every year in Poland Spring just 100 years ago.
Yeah, it's changed a lot. I mean, even where we're at, as you mentioned, races were getting canceled, and we had the lowest snow year, I believe, in a century in South Central Alaska last year. We're typically running hundreds and hundreds of miles, if not a month, definitely a season. I think that we only ran, and we weren't doing Iditarod training or anything, I think we ran less last year than we've ran any other year in Alaska. So climate change is real. Obviously, it's our job as stewards of not only the sport and the lifestyle and all that, but to teach people about that. And I know that you're now a guide here in Maine. Is that a big part of your education, is to talk to people about appropriate uses of the land and becoming stewards and all that? You know, in typical outdoor leadership, we're big on leave no trace and pack in everything you pack out. How do you approach that now that you've been in the wilderness like that?
Yeah, I've always, both in my college career studying wildlife biology, and I worked for the state for the Department of Conservation. And now as a biology teacher and an outdoor leader with a registered Maine guide, conservation, and I mean, even if there were no climate, and we all know, it's obvious there is climate change. I mean, we know that, we look back at the Viking Age, Vinland, and, you know, it was actually a mini ice age that stopped their expansion into North America because of these cycles. The planet has these cycles. We are probably magnifying and contributing to these cycles. But, you know, even that aside, we have a moral obligation to conservation. We, the human race has a moral obligation to conservation. Every year in my classroom, I have a debate, and I don't tell them who's right or wrong. I just, I judge it based on the merits of the effort that they put in. But every year, my high schoolers debate each other as to whether wolves should be reintroduced to the North Woods of Maine. And, you know, these kinds of things, just to get them thinking about, you know, just to get them thinking about what our impact has been and what, therefore, our obligations are. If we set things out of balance, what can we do to put things back into balance again? And a lot of that, to me, has to do with conservation land. It's one of the few things. I'm a very libertarian-minded kind of live and let live kind of person. You know, you mind your business, I'll mind mine, and you know, don't tell me what to do in my backyard, and I won't tell you what to do in your backyard. But there's one thing that I really think, with Theodore Roosevelt and John Muir and in that time period, one thing that America got right. You know, they have the castles and the cathedrals and everything in Europe. We have our national parks. What we have that Europe doesn't have are these beautiful, wide open spaces and these pristine wildernesses. That's what we have. You know, that's what America has. And we have to preserve those. We have to try and enrich them. We need to try to expand them. So that's, and regardless of political party, you know, that's not a political issue. You know, this is the richest heritage that America has, as opposed to countries that have been around for thousands of years, is nature. You know, it is what is the wilderness areas that we have, and we need to be protecting those.
Excellent. Jonathan, I have just three questions left in this series, and these are the big picture questions. They may or may not be in the correct order, but I'm going to ask them in this order anyway. So the first question is, what's next? What's coming up next for you? Any way you want to answer this one, let's hear about it.
I'm going to continue banging off some Iditarod qualifiers. I will have a second Iditarod qualifier done this year. It would be really nice if the Iditarod considered our trailblazing in the 700-mile expedition as my third Iditarod qualifier. I doubt they'll make that exception, but who knows? If not, I'll have to, you know, get up to Alaska to get another 300-miler done. I would like to run the Iditarod just to have that experience. You know, it's a different experience. Not harder, not easier. Just, you know, it's different. And doing that with my dogs, and I'd have to learn a lot more about my dogs before I do it. You know, what is a Cephalo-Siberian's run rest cycle, as opposed, what is their natural pace? You know, they aren't Alaskan Huskies, so let's look at them as an individual breed and see how best they're going to shine in these situations. So that's at a bare minimum. I've gotten looking at offering a overnight dog sled experience in Maine so that people can come and experience these dogs, maybe doing some canoe guiding. But for the breed preservation, my goal is just to see another generation come on that's as serious about it as some of us, I'm not 50 yet, and us old timers, you know, that grabbed the torch in our 20s and 30s. We need some people to step up and say, yeah, you know, we're going to do this. It's not easy. It's getting harder. Having a big kennel of dogs, which is required for the type of running that Cephalos do. You know, you can have a small sprint team, and that's great, and we're really encouraging it. Actually, we've changed the club point rules for earning titles on the Cephalos to include sprint racing and dry land racing. It used to be just mid and distance focused. So we've changed that this year to encourage more people to come on. But I can only have so many dogs in my backyard. And you know, there's about 5 Cephalo kennels in North America, and there needs to be 25, you know, and we're just looking for that next generation, encouraging that next generation to step in and say, you know, I want to commit to this long term.
We're going to talk about legacy in this just a second, but you have a book that you're working on. Let's talk about that briefly. Do you have a title? Do you have an idea of publishing, when it's going to be available?
Yeah, I don't have a title. I have a couple working titles. I'm not sure if it's going to be The Great Race of Mercy or The Race Against Death, which are both terms that were used for the original Serum Run. But then it's going to say A Centennial Expedition. Get really personal in it. You know, I share some of the more intimate moments that, you know, I don't have time to share in podcasts, or, you know, and definitely aren't going to make it into a hour and a half documentary. So if people want the real scuttle on, you know, even down to, you know, specific stories of particular dogs on the team, members of the team, you know, the way we came together, you know, possible times of friction, you know, those things, you know, along with the harrowing stories, all that's going to be in detail. fully exposed in the book.
Speaking of documentary, that's on the horizon. You had a team member that we've talked a lot about, Caleb. His job was to document this for a future project. What does that look like? Do you have a timeline for our listeners?
He is courting potential syndications, be it, Discovery, History, Animal Planet. He's courting those, but at the very minimum, his goal is to have it released during the 2025 year, probably around October. And at the very minimum, it's going to be made available on YouTube, so everyone will be able to watch it at that time.
Are you thinking about doing, this is probably early in the thought process, but thinking about doing film festivals and things like you did before with your other documentary?
I am a public school teacher, and my wife hasn't even heard this daydream yet, but I have Poland Spring, as you know. Poland Spring Resort is where Sepala established his first kennel, and I am more than 500 miles away from that in northernmost Maine now. And being a school teacher and it becoming the state dog, I thought it'd be a great opportunity for me to mush from school to school, from the northern tip of Maine down to Poland Spring, and go to the schools and show the documentary, because it's now the official state dog, and introduce these school students to why, this dog is their state dog.
I've got to ask here, this is not on the list, but Sepala Siberian as the state dog, you are the only breeder in the state. Do you have the state dog, and who is that? Do you have this?
Yeah, we do.
Who so, is that?
So the poster child of the state dog, Caleb, the filmmaker that came with us on the expedition, when he was here for our Expedition 101 training weekend, he took a lot of photos. And there's a very photogenic dog that we have. His name is Hatchet. He's actually my son, who's in the Marine Corps, currently serving. Caleb, it's his dog, technically. I gave it to him for his 18th birthday, but he can't take it with him on deployment. So Hatchet is the poster child of the state dog. And I had my 7th graders do PowerPoint presentations on the new state dog, just finding that humorous, because they didn't know when they started the project that I had anything to do with it until they started doing the research. And on most of their slide presentations, Hatchet was the first dog on the first slide, because it's just somehow those photos have taken hold with the media here in the state, the news, and the news sources, the TV and the newspapers have all been using Hatchet.
All right, guys, we are going to share a photo of Hatchet in our show notes on mushing.com. You will see the poster child for the state dog of Maine.
Awesome.
As we're listening. Okay, two more questions here. Looking back on this now, it's been about 6 months at the time of this recording. That's in the rear view. What is one thing you would have done differently if you were at this very moment getting ready to plan and do this trip today? What would you do different, just one thing?
I would have done more caches of supplies and hauling less.
Okay.
That was me trying to consolidate. I had a misconception of how the freighting system worked in Alaska, and I thought the fewer drops I had, the more money I would save, and it's strictly by the pound. I could have delivered my supplies to
every spot
for the same amount of money that it took me. So that was a mistake that I made for sure. We could have, every 2 or 3 days gotten a resupply instead of just 3 times over the course of a month.
Okay, that's it.
That's one.
That's the big one. All right. If there's others, maybe we'll include that coming up. Okay, here we go. Jonathan, we've spent 6 hours together now or so talking about this. We've talked a lot about what you want to do with the dogs, preservation, conservation. We've talked about climate. We've talked about trails. We've talked about team building, leadership, expedition planning, all of that. I want to preface that with a couple of things before we start. The first one is, I remember talking to my wife about this when you were getting ready to go, and she's been involved with this lifestyle for a long time. And she said to me, why do you think you, and she knows you, why do you think he's doing this? And I remember telling her that every day people are out doing big things, whether they're doing a 5K or a trip like yours or summiting Everest or, you know, a road trip across America. Everybody has these little things that people are doing all the time. And we hope that we're doing them so we can share this experience, especially in today's age. But this is all about legacy of this trip and others. So that's sort of the first part of that. Why was your little trip important? Second is, Norman Vaughn said one time, dream big and dare to fail. I know you've talked a lot about that, and I'm sure you're very familiar with Norman Vaughn and, yeah, and what he did. That was sort of his take-home point. But the question is, how do you want this to define your legacy? Not necessarily the dog's legacy, but the Jonathan Hayes legacy. What do you want people to remember this in 25, 50, 200-year anniversary of this? Go for it.
That's a big question. So I'll start with Michelle's question to you. I didn't start down this road to run Sevlas. I just wanted to be out in the woods with some, you know, dogs. I love dogs and love the winter and just wanted to go. And then one thing just keeps growing into something else. But I don't believe in chance. I am a firm believer in that our steps are ordered in the hand of Providence. I believe that the Sevlas found their way to me in the state of Maine, which is where Leonard Sevla 100 years ago established his first Sevla kennels. I believe that it's not chance that I was the same age he was on the 100-year anniversary of him doing what he did. I believe that all of those steps are ordered. And it's interesting because the KNOM radio in Nome, they interviewed me the day after, and he told me, he said, have you read the comment that your dad left on social media? And I hadn't. And my dad, who, you know, he's a theologian, he's written 20 books on theology, and he said, Jonathan just did what he was called to do at this stage in his life. This was his moment to do this. And I don't know why. I mean, in the big scheme of things, it does seem kind of silly, you know, but I just really feel like I was called to do this in this moment with these dogs at this time. As far as my personal legacy, and that's for the legacy of the dogs. As far as my personal legacy, you know, if I can hope to, and this is only going to make sense to people who geek out on Sepala Siberian sled dog history, but Leonard Sepala passed the torch on to Harry Wheeler in Quebec, and Harry Wheeler passed it on to J.D. McFowell, and J.D. McFowell passed it on to Jeffrey Bragg and Doug Willett.
And this is all through 100 years.
Yes, sir. And then Doug Willett and Jeffrey Bragg, I worked with both of them and got dogs from both of them. And so if I can have done something to, you know, have my name named in that list of Sepala stewards, you know, passing on that torch, then that'll be something to me. But, you know, I have a lot of kids, and I'm very proud of my children, and they're all daring to dream big. One of them, you know, Kabul, Afghanistan combat veteran, the other one decided he was going to outdo his infantry brother and go into force recon. And then my third son wants to blaze his own trail. So he graduates tomorrow and then is shipping out the week after to be special forces in the Air Force. And you know, just this desire to do something bigger than yourself, you know, to do something significant and bigger than yourself, and that you can do it. You know, I'm not a rich man. If anyone knows what the salary is of a public school teacher, you know, and then you add to that, you know, children and dogs and, you know,
this time.
Just an expensive undertaking. But, you know, where there's a will, there's a way. I didn't have the money to do this. And when I decided I was going to do it, I didn't have the money to do it. And when I left Maine for the 5,000-mile, 5-day road trip, nonstop, rotating drivers, I didn't have the money to get us home. And that's a common story with the explorers of the golden age of exploration. A lot of them set out not knowing how they were going to pay the bills when they got home. But you believe in something bigger than yourself, and you just say it's going to work itself out. I'm not sure how yet, but this is going to work out. And then just push. And as Norman Vaughn said, you know, dare to dream big enough to fail. I love Will Steger was asked, why do you do this stuff? And his answer was a little bit sharper than I care to give to someone. I like to be a little kinder. But he said, if you have to ask me that question, there's no answer I can give you that's going to make any sense to you.
And by the way, if you have not seen his documentary about his trek across Antarctica, it's on Amazon Prime. Definitely go check that out. Anything else on legacy?
The man is a force, you know, yeah. And that's just it. It's just like some of us are driven to, some people are just hardwired to do these kinds of things. And there are people who understand it and people that don't. And trying to explain it to the people who don't understand it is hard, you know, because sometimes you're asking yourself the question, you know, when you're pulling yourself in the middle of the night in 50 below zero temperatures, pulling yourself out of a pond and, you know, trying to dry off your dogs and you've got 2 hours to mush, you're asking yourself, why the heck am I doing this? But there's this internal drive that some people have and just part of who we are, you know?
So I said that was the last question, but I have to ask this one. So, 2125, so 200th anniversary. What do you think people are going to remember about the Serum Run and all of that? You know, it's still kind of fresh in our mind. What do you think they're going to think about 200 years from that original trip? You think anything? Do you think we'll just be so awash, Black Mirror style on Netflix, where we don't remember any of that? Or is there going to still be a place in history for that?
I'm afraid that we won't remember any of it. And that's a big reason, you know, like I said, I think some of these things are worth preserving. I think that this story in particular serves as a great reminder in this, and I know in 100 years this is going to sound funny me saying this, but in this modern technological age in which we live, where we're surrounded by technology, this story serves to remind us that there are things that our ancestors did that worked really, really well for a good reason. And 100 years ago, the planes couldn't get in the air. And this year, the snow machines couldn't make it to Nome without breaking down. Like, you know, we were showing the wisdom of this centuries-old legacy, you know. And I think it's a story that deserves to be retold over and over and over again to remind us we're not as smart as we think we are, and we've not advanced as far as we think we have, you know. And not to get off on some crazy rabbit trail, but all you have to do is look at Stonehenge and the hundreds of miles that these, you know, prehistoric men moved those stones, or look at, you know, at the pyramids in Egypt, and you could go on and on, you know, talking about, you know, we think we're so smart because we have these little tech devices in our hands. But the human race has forgotten more than we know. And, you know, and it serves as a good reminder that that progress isn't always, you know, the best answer. That sometimes, legacy, heritage, sometimes tradition and custom has something beautiful to teach us that's worth preserving into the future.
Good stuff, man. Is there anything else you want to mention to this audience before we close? Any parting words, any promotion, anything? Or you're good?
No, I would invite everyone to follow us and, you know, on social media at Mush Maine and on our website, mushmaine.com. I'm looking forward to interviewing you on my Explorer podcast tomorrow. And getting that published, but that'll probably come out long before this will. And just, you know, go out and do something, dare to dream big, dream about something, and then, you know, don't find excuses to give up on it. Find a reason to push forward. You're going to find what you're looking for. And if you're looking for an excuse to give up, you're going to find that. But if you're looking for a reason to persevere and to keep pushing to make your dreams a reality, you're going to find that too. So look for the right things.
And that's that 5K or
that's
anything.
It could be anything.
Yep. Yeah. All right, guys. Jonathan Hayes is our guest on this series. It was a pleasure. I'm glad I was able to come up and do this in person.
Yeah,
I think that adds
so
a little flavor to this, even though we're sitting in a hotel in Bangor, Maine. But it's been awesome. Jonathan, thank you very much.
It's an honor. Thank you for having
thank
me.
Thank you. On behalf of that, guys, be sure you check out the entire series. It's all on mushing.com. We will see you guys next time. Goodbye.
Are you a fan of the great outdoors? Do you enjoy the thrill of speed and adventure? Then listen up. Introducing Mushing, your ultimate guide to the exciting world of dog-powered sports and mushing. Whether you're a seasoned musher or just starting out, Mushing has got you covered. Get ready to immerse yourself in captivating stories of incredible sled dog races, expert training tips from seasoned professionals, and gear reviews to help you make the right choices for your team. From the breathtaking landscapes of Alaska to the snowy trails of Scandinavia, Mushing takes you on a thrilling journey through the world of dog-powered sports. Don't miss out on the latest issue, packed with exclusive interviews with top mushers, in-depth articles on sled dog nutrition, and stunning photography that will transport you to the heart of the action. So whether you're dreaming of competing in the Iditarod or simply want to learn more about this incredible sport, Mushing is your go-to resource. Subscribe now and get ready to unleash your passion for mushing. Visit our website at mushing.com or find us on your favorite podcast platform. Mushing, where the spirit of adventure meets the power of the pack.